So 12 years ago now, my younger sister, age 42, died of a form of cancer called soft tissue sarcoma. Now, this did not feel just to any of us in the family because she never smoked. She stopped drinking alcohol in her teens. She didn't eat meat. She just ate healthy vegetables and fruits. She did yoga exercises, so she kept her body in shape. She practiced meditation twice a day, every day. Why would she get cancer? How unjust. Well, scientists don't know why a few people develop this rare sarcoma that my sister had. But one day in the hospital, she gave me her own theory. A meditator, a believer in yoga, she had developed a Hindu philosophy of life. She believed in reincarnation. And during one of my visits, she said to me, "I must have done something really bad in a past life to be given this cancer in this life." Now, her statement is a belief system that all of us have encountered. All of us have been taught at one time or another. From an early age, our elders teach us that life rewards good behavior and punishes bad. Children who study hard and get good grades will be successful and happy. As adults, our culture tells us to exercise, to eat properly, and maintain a positive mental attitude. In exchange, we expect to be rewarded with money, with friends, with happiness, with good health, and a long life. Those of us who do not follow these rules will suffer. We can trace this view back thousands of years. In the book of Proverbs, it says, "No ills befall the righteous, but the wicked are filled with trouble." In Isaiah, it says, "Tell the righteous it shall be well with them, for they shall eat the fruit of their deeds. Woe to the wicked, it shall be ill with them, for what their hands have done shall be done to them." Supporting this view of life was the idea of a covenant with God, a contract with the Almighty. The covenant was an agreement to follow the Ten Commandments, in exchange for which the Jewish people expected to receive fair treatment from God. Now, an anonymous author wrote the story of Job in this historical context. Biblical scholars believe that there is a first Job and a second Job. The reading I gave you is the first Job, the original story. It's about how incredibly faithful, how incredibly loyal Job is in spite of all the suffering. Satan comes to God, and God points out to Satan what a good person Job is. The cynical Satan says that Job is only a good person because Job has everything he wants. Satan challenges God, suggesting that they make Job suffer to see if Job retains his loyal faith. Accepting the challenge, God joins with Satan in playing this sadistic game with poor, loyal Job. God grants Satan permission to strip Job of all his possessions, to kill his children, and to give Job a terrible, painful disease. Both Job's wife and his friends urge him to curse God, but in the original story, still, Job remains faithful. God wins the bet with Satan. Making an appearance on earth, God reprimands Job's friends for their bad advice, and then he rewards Job for his faithfulness, for his loyalty. Job gets his health back, he gets a new home, he gets new wealth, and even gets new children. The moral of this original story of Job is that we should keep our faith in God even when we have bad luck. The story tells us that God has reasons for what God does, and if we hold on to our faith long enough, God will compensate us for our suffering. But the biblical story that we have today is not that simple. Biblical scholars believe that there's a first Job and a second Job, and these somehow got mixed together in one book. About 2,500 years ago, a Jewish poet mixed the second version of Job with the first version. This confusing mixture of the two stories is what we today read as the book of Job in the Old Testament. The researchers think that someone wrote the second version of Job around 587 BC. This was when Nebuchadnezzar totally destroyed Jerusalem and destroyed Solomon's temple. Nebuchadnezzar deported much of the Jewish population, numbering about 10,000, to Babylon. The scholars speculate that this event, this horrible experience of their city being destroyed and being forced into exile, this horrible thing forced a rethinking of the book of Job. Jews could no longer offer the same loyalty to God after the terrible suffering they had experienced during the siege of Jerusalem. They could no longer accept the story of Job's blind obedience to God. So 2,500 years ago, an anonymous poet rewrote the story, turning the story completely around. In the second version, Job is no longer the pious man who blesses God no matter what happens to him. Job, in the second story, screams out against the injustice. "Why are my children dying?" Job asks. "Why is my home destroyed? Why is my body covered in boils?" In the second story, Job's friends come to him and they say all the traditional pious things. They tell Job, "God has a reason for everything that happens. Keep your faith. Trust in God." Job's friends remind him that according to their religion, God rewards good and punishes evil. Suffering is a form of divine discipline. Therefore, they say, "God must have something against you, Job." Now, Job would not accept the theology of these friends. He swears his innocence. "I'm not a wicked person," Job says. He says that he has fed and sheltered the poor. He says he's never taken anything that did not belong to him, and that he has never been vain or boastful. Job asks God for proof. "Give me proof, God, that I've been sinful." Well, at that point in the story, suddenly God appears before Job. God does not talk about Job's sinfulness or about Job's suffering. God does not promise a heaven of goodness and wonder and beauty in the future. Instead, God asks Job a question. He says to Job, "Where were you during the creation of the earth?" God asks Job, "Have you ever tried to run the earth?" God says to Job, "If you've never tried to run the universe, don't attack me for the way I run it." Now, most modern clergy conclude that this is simply another way of saying, "Job, you're an ignorant, foolish human being. You have no right to question God's wisdom and justice. Therefore, you should simply accept your suffering, have faith in God, and not ask questions." But there's another interpretation. And I first came across this interpretation several years ago when I read the best-selling book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, by a rabbi named Harold Kushner. Kushner says that the poet who wrote the second story of Job is saying something radical about God. Something radical about God. The author of the second Job is saying, God is not all-powerful. God is not all-powerful. Kushner writes, bad things do happen to good people in this world, but it is not God who wills it. God would like people to get what they deserve in life, but God cannot always arrange it. Forced to choose between a good God who is not totally powerful or a powerful God who is not totally good, the author of the book of Job chooses to believe in God's goodness. So all of us, all people everywhere, we try to live good lives. Nevertheless, many of us have bad things happen to us that are much worse than we deserve. We lose our jobs, we are in accidents, our children get sick, war harms us. When these things happen, our first reaction is to cry out, just as Job cried out, what did we do to deserve this? Kushner is suggesting that when bad things happen, God is not punishing us for our sins because God is not all-powerful. Sometimes we can find no reason to explain what happens. Cancer comes for no reason. Cars fail for no reason. A child is born with a birth defect for no reason. Bombs fall on one house and not another. God is not punishing or rewarding anyone. These awful, tragic things happen randomly. People suffer greatly for no reason. Now, if we stick to that old belief that God is all-powerful, that God guarantees just treatment and happy endings, there may be some comfort in that as long as we're not suffering terribly. However, this kind of comfort is possible only if we ignore the suffering of innocent victims. Once we have seen an innocent person suffer and die, it is no longer easy to believe that God is always just. When we have suffered a terrible loss, when a family member or a close friend has suffered a terrible loss, when we have a serious accident or illness, believing in an all-powerful God is difficult. Now, in 1958, a poet, Archibald MacLeish, completed a modern version of the Job story in the form of a two-act play. MacLeish called his play J.B. It won the 1959 Puzzler Prize for Drama and the 1959 Tony Award for Best Play and Best Direction. J.B., the Job figure in a modern setting, is a successful New York banker. He's surrounded by an attractive, loving family. Now, in the play, Mr. Zeus is God, and Nichols is Satan. They overhear J.B. describing his wealth as a just reward for his faithfulness to God. Cynical Nichols wagers that J.B. will curse God if J.B.'s life is ruined. Nichols and Zeus then watch as one by one, J.B.'s children die. His business fails. His health fails. Finally, a war destroys his whole city and much of the world. Three friends visit J.B. to comfort him. The first comforter is a Marxist. He assures J.B. that none of his suffering is his fault. He has just had the bad luck to be a member of the wrong economic class at the wrong time. The second comforter is a psychiatrist. J.B. is not guilty, the psychiatrist says, because guilt does not exist. Freedom of choice is an illusion. We act because of our instincts, and we have no control over our instincts. Therefore, we have no responsibility and no guilt. The third and last comforter is a minister. He says that all human beings are born sinners. J.B. is suffering, says the minister, simply because he is a human being. And all human beings suffer from original sin. God, the minister says, made people imperfect and now is punishing them for their imperfections. Now, J.B. did not find either of these three friends comforting. So he turns to God. And Archie MacLeish quotes lines directly from the biblical speech of God speaking to Job. God says to J.B., if you think that keeping unfair things from happening is easy, you try it. God says to J.B., I'm not all powerful. I can't control everything. J.B. forgives God for God's imperfections, and decides to go on living. He goes back to his wife, and she wisely sums up in 12 words the message of the story of Job. She says to her husband, you wanted justice, didn't you? There isn't any. There's only love. Now, I would slightly modify this statement. I believe there is justice sometimes, but not always. And there is always the capacity to love. Sometimes life is fair. Sometimes life is just, and we can be glad when this is the case. However, we cannot count on life being fair. We may eat the right kind of food, we may exercise, we maintain a positive mental attitude, we may treat others with respect, and we still may be struck down by a random act of violence. Sometimes justice does happen, but we cannot count on justice. We cannot count on fairness. All we can count on is our own capacity to love and the capacity of others to love us. When I served in Bethesda at the Unitarian Universalist Church there, one of the members of my congregation was a woman named Mimi MacLeish Grimm, Archibald MacLeish's daughter. Mimi understood the words of her father. You want justice, don't you? There isn't any. There is only love. She devoted her own life to teaching and caring for children. She spent her Sunday mornings, she never came to church. She never came to hear me preach. She spent her Sunday mornings for over 40 years teaching and the Unitarian Universalist Church's Sunday morning nursery school class, including one year teaching my own daughter. She knew how to love those children. She would teach them, tell them stories, hug them. I loved to visit her class. Mimi's caring presence reminded me of her father's words. You want justice, don't you? There isn't any. There is only love. So 12 years ago, my sister, at the age of 42, was dying of a form of cancer called soft tissue sarcoma. A believer in reincarnation, she did not fear death. Indeed, at the end, she welcomed death because she was confident that her soul, her spirit, would be born into a new body. She did not believe in assisted suicide, so she let the illness take its course. She got pain relief from morphine. However, during one of my visits, she said to me, "I must have done something really bad in a past life to be given this cancer in this life." And I told her what I believed. I said to my sister, "Sometimes there is no reason. I don't know what caused your cancer. Perhaps a very toxic form of radiation was created by an exploding star millions of years ago, and that a small beam of that radiation reached Earth and traveled through our atmosphere, and you just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and got hit by it. It entered your body and created a cancerous cell that slowly spread. Who knows how you got this? Some things happen for no reason. There is randomness to the universe. Sometimes we just have bad luck." "But," she said, "what about God?" And I said to her, "If God exists, God is not all powerful. We live in a world that includes illness and unemployment, accidents, war. We have a responsibility to help make this world better. But in the end, in spite of all of our efforts, we suffer tragedies in our lives. And I know of no way to escape from these tragedies." "But," she asked again, "Roger, do you believe in God?" And I said to my sister something like this. I said, "I define God as the unity that underlies all of our existence, all of our experience." I told her that I experience this unity through the relationships that I have with other people, with her, our family, with the people in my congregation. That I experience this unity also in the wonderful earth, the beauty of the earth. And I feel it also in beautiful works of art, in music, in paintings, in drama. There are moments when I feel this sense of unity. It occurs when I exchange a smile with another person. It's a sense of unity I feel when I hear the sounds of beautiful music. It's a sense of love I feel when I laugh with others. I told her, "I don't see this unity as an all-powerful force that controls our lives, but as a connection that I have with other people and with the whole universe." And I said to her, "Feeling connected, failures, disappointments, suffering, it's all a little more bearable. Grief is a little more bearable." I said, "I don't know how to make this happen for you or for others, except to say that for me, it arises out of loving relationships. I find joy in knowing that others love me and that I can love. It doesn't take away the pain, but it makes life worth all that goes into it."